Hello and welcome to this week's Convets Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. If you ask any of my friends or family, they'll tell you I'm not exactly a goddess in the kitchen. But during lockdown, I stumbled upon this week's guest cooking delicious, easy-to-make dishes on Instagram. Food and travel journalist John Gregory Smith travels all over the world, discovering beautiful flavours, searching for the best recipes, and drawing inspiration from traditional methods and trends. Much to my daughter's amusement and ridicule, I found myself slightly addicted to popping him on the counter whilst following his upbeat instructions, a habit which has turned my culinary skills around. So I am absolutely delighted to say that John joins me in person now. John, it's great to finally chat to you as opposed to having you on repeat on the worktop.
I know, I was going to say I'm very small, but I don't think I'll be able to fit even on your counter.
Oh, you were perfect on my counter. I had to sort of listen to what you were saying, and then why my daughter thought it was hysterical is I'd pause it and then I'd re-rack it again and listen again because I'm not a great cook. But honestly, you've took me on this amazing journey, not just with the food, but with stories of your travels and everything as we did it. And you really have turned my life around, and you've taken the fear away from the kitchen and enabled me to be so much more adventurous.
That's amazing, because really, that's sort of like my job done. That's what I was brought up with. I have a huge family and all we do is eat and drink together. Best thing ever. And then I just got into this career, and it's sort of passing on that knowledge or that fun and that enthusiasm and that confidence. That's sort of what I do, I guess, because to hear things like that, it's just gold dust. I love it.
Oh, what I love about your Insta films is how relaxed and enthusiastic you are when you're cooking and how simple you make everything. I mean, making those films, is that been a bit of a family affair, John, during lockdown?
Yeah, massively, because before lockdown, I used to do lots of different things. I mean, you know how it is slightly in our industry, you have to have your fingers in lots of different pies. So I do a bit of TV, a bit of books, a bit of journalism, a bit of charity work, and it would all sort of feed in together. Then when COVID hit, a lot of those work streams disappeared pretty quickly, shall we say. So I was like, I don't really know what to do. And I thought, look, I'm just going to cook the kind of food that I'm cooking at home, which was perhaps a lot more tempered than what I'd been doing professionally beforehand. Just quicker, easier, more family stuff. So I actually went to live with my sister and I just got everybody involved. So I was like, well, I need to still keep producing content because I've got to have something to do. And I can do the stills and things on my own. When I say that, I mean, there's just the food photography I can do on my own. But to do a video, you need someone to focus it or tell you your hair's gone mad or you've got like tahini all over your face, and it's just more fun. And originally, because the kids were on holiday, I got my sister's kids literally to do it, and they were brilliant. So there was three of them, Daisy, Jake, Dylan. It was just so fun. But also I'd want to be cooking things that they could enjoy rather than just, you know, filming something really kind of weird and wonderful that they just would sort of stare at from afar. And it sort of happened organically. I'm now doing it back with my mum because I'm allowed to work with her again. And it's just hysterical because she's probably the only person who just tells me to shut up and get on with things. And it's just so fun.
And were you surprised at the response it got and the messages that people left you on Instagram?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the beginning of lockdown, certainly when it was sort of pretty scary, food was really the one nice thing that we could depend on, you know, just a good home cooked meal. Everyone went kind of cooking crazy and it went mad, you know, like my account went bonkers. It's lovely to see that, and that kind of made me want to do more and more and more.
I think we all had cupboard clear outs as well, and I remember going in our spice and herb rack.
What
and
did you find?
Well, I found things that I thought, oh, I'll just hang on to this and try and use it, and then I looked underneath and it said, you know, expired in January 2012 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Horrific. But now there's none of that. Now it's full of all sorts of new things that I run out of regularly, like turmeric and all sorts of exciting
How
things.
Wicked. All neatly arranged, I hope, still.
All neatly arranged, of course. Cupboards are now all clean. That's another thing that we all did. But to give everyone an idea of what your cooking films are like, here you are in action making one of my favourite new dishes, chicken puttanesca.
So we've browned off that chicken. It's gorgeous. It's golden. It's got all of that lovely flavour over it. But I want even more. I want to make the most amazing puttanesca sauce. So in my hot pan, in with the garlic, hear that sizzle, chuck in those anchovies. Now they've got the most amazing salty flavour and they're just melting down into that oil. So now they're all ready. You can see that they've just gone. I'm going to add in some capers, chopped olives, a little chilli because I love that kick and that's so important in this sauce. And then finally, just a tin of chopped tomatoes to bring it all together. I'm just going to stir that You can see it's already bubbling and all those wonderful flavours are filling the kitchen. I'm going to pour that over the chicken, rip in the mozzarella, chuck it in the oven.
It's so easy to make something tasty, isn't it, John, with just a few tricks of the trade and also having that confidence to use some different ingredients that to you are probably very straightforward, but, you know, ingredients that I wouldn't often play with. I'm thinking anchovies and things like that.
Yeah, no, 100%. And do you know what I love? Because with my family, they're all quite good cooks, but my sister's got kids, my brother's got kids, my mum's like a really throw together cook. And it was really interesting just sort of speaking to them about dishes, kind of, you know, I'd run things past them. And what they'd always say is, look, do things that we recognise and just put a couple of things that we don't know in, but things that are very easy to get. And I think that was the key. And I think that's done me favours, actually, because if you do something completely new with all new ingredients that are really hard to get, people just won't. Whereas if you do something simple, which essentially chicken puttanesca is a gorgeous chicken in a tomato sauce, but where it's sort of like beefed up a little bit is with anchovies. And now everyone immediately pulls a funny face with anchovies, but when you melt them in the oil, they just disappear. And like soy sauce, they just give this sort of wonderful salty element. And actually, once you know that and you've seen it and you, more importantly, tasted it, you kind of go, that's such a great little trick. They last in the fridge for ages. They're cheap. They're brilliant. So just things like that were wonderful.
I can remember as well that it's four. And I can remember you saying melting because you do it in such an, you know, an enthusiastic fashion. And it's interesting you say about simple dishes, because the very first recipe I stumbled upon was your homemade hummus.
Yes.
And we've got a little clip of you making that, which I've made at least 6 or 7 times now and have stopped buying supermarket hummus because it's so delicious. So here you are making your hummus.
I promised you easy peasy, and it isn't easier than this. I chuck in a can of chickpeas, and all I've done is drain them and kept that gorgeous water because that's got so much flavour and all the starch. So I'm going to pour in about 100ml of that water to start with. Lovely big load of tahini, which has got that gorgeous sesame paste and takes me right back to Lebanon every time. Clove of garlic, pinch of salt, squeeze a lemon, and all I'm going to do is blitz it.
There's little tricks, aren't there, John, in that, like bothering to peel your chickpeas?
Yes, I mean, hummus is a funny one. It's a very, very old dish with a lot of sort of heritage towards it and a lot of people kind of claiming it as their own. That I've avoided. But, you know, there's all sorts of tricks from soaking chickpeas overnight to actually peeling the skins off afterwards. And I frankly, life's too short, I think. Don't judge. But the easy version, because a lot of people were saying, this is great, but I want hummus and I haven't got dry chickpeas and I've not soaked them and I can't be bothered. So hit me. What do I do? So I did that quick and easy one. And it's funny, I did it, put it on Instagram recently and it's had 600,000 views, which is just so weird. But how great. Everybody loves it.
599,000 are probably me with you on repeat.
Don't spoil my fun.
No. Actually, no. That was quite mean, didn't I? I didn't mean it like that, honestly.
It's mainly my mum. Don't worry about it.
And of course, Middle Eastern cooking and North African cooking is very much your sort of signature style, isn't it?
Really, my career started by accident as a writer, and it was sort of because I had a failed business and I just decided to run away for a bit. And whilst I was traveling, I went to all sorts of different places, but it was that part of the world that really captivated me. I think it's so different from ours in good and bad, but it just really got me. And then the food is just incredible. It's old, it's stunning. Flavours are so beautiful. As someone who writes books, it's the most amazing job, really, to be able to kind of go to these wonderful places and live there for a few months and just soak it up and then write about it. And I think my books are much more of a deep dive than, say, what I've been doing online. I tend to keep that, and actually in my Telegraph column as well, that's all much more every day. But it was the Middle East that just... it just really tickled me. I love it. And I love the flavours.
Before we head to some of the many exotic places you visited and hear a little bit more about how that failed business that you mentioned there did actually, in many ways, turn your life around and take you in a completely different and exciting direction, how did you get into cooking in the first place? I mean, you did mention right at the beginning, food was a big thing growing up, wasn't it?
Yeah. So my family, like we... all of us live in London. We're very British. I mean, you can tell by my surname, and I'm incredibly pale as well. So we're like dead British, but we sort of hang out like a big pack all the time. There's tons of us. So it's me, my brother, my sister, my mum, dad, all my cousins, aunties, uncles, loads of children. We see each other all the time. It's obviously harder now because of all getting together, because there's about 30 of us. But it's just been that thing. We always get together, always around a meal. And it's just so wonderful. And that's what got me into food. I think I'm the youngest of the cousins. So there's obviously now like a world of grandchildren. But I realized at quite a young age that if you wanted a look in, because everybody's older and taller than me, the best way to do it was if you made the food. So I realized if I cook lunch, everyone would be like, oh no, you help yourself first. Because otherwise everyone would just shove me out of the way or do that really annoying thing that like older siblings do where they just yoink something off your plate with a fork. Actually, my brother still does that a little bit now. So I just was kind of like, look, if I cook it, I'm in control and I can get served first. And it really started like that. And then just getting really interested in different foods. And it was Indian and Chinese at the beginning that I just loved. I'm talking about when I was about 11 or 12. It was quite unfun in a way. It was like British didn't really exist. It was all like Italian and French. And then I remember seeing Ken Hom. He's that amazing Chinese chef. He used to have a little moustache. And then Mada Jaffrey on TV. And I was like, wait a minute, what is this joy that they're making? So I'd get my mum to drive me to Southall, which is like West London, Northwest really. And it's got a really big kind of Indian, Bangladeshi and Pakistani community. So I'd go and buy spices and ingredients there, or to this really random supermarket in Wembley called Hu Hing, which is still there now. And I'd go and buy all the sauces and condiments that you then couldn't get in a supermarket. I just loved it. And that sort of got me straight into food and cookery.
And that was quite young, wasn't it? When you were getting your mum to drive you to Wembley for your Chinese ingredients and stuff. You weren't that old, were you?
I was super young. Yeah, yeah. Like kind of literally 11, 12 is when I started. And then sort of as a teenager, you know, obviously there were other fun things that got in the way, but I certainly loved cooking the whole time. And it was really when I was at sixth form college, that was when I was like, well, should I go and train to be a chef? And what I did, I'm smirking because it's such a silly story. My sister, who's just so funny, met Gordon Ramsay in a bar. It was called Mint, which now doesn't exist. It was in Knightsbridge. And she basically said, my brother loves cooking. Will you give him a job? And he amazingly said, yes.
He
had a few margaritas. Yeah. And it was this long ago that he said, like, here's the fax number for the office. So I faxed that number the next day, kind of thinking my sister had made it all up. Anyway, I got reply back going, yeah, no, he said you were going to fax. So give us a call. Let's arrange what is called a stash. It was basically work experience. So I went to Royal Hospital Road, which is his flagship restaurant, and it's phenomenal. I mean, I'd actually never, ever at the time, I'd heard of fine dining. I didn't know anything about it because, again, the restaurant scene back then was completely different. You either went to McDonald's or you went to a Michelin star restaurant. And, you know, I certainly wasn't doing that. And so I rock up. Absolutely no one said a word to me for the first day because I think they thought that I was there to steal someone's job. And it was outside. I said to someone, like, this is so weird. You know, I'm only here for work experience. I've never worked in a kitchen ever. And I'm actually studying my A-levels. And they were like, oh, okay, cool. And then it sort of opened up to me and it was brilliant fun. But I tell you what, it put me right off being a professional chef because it's so intense. Oh my goodness.
It's such hard work, isn't it? And literally the heat in the kitchen, not just the physical heat, but the mental strain and stress of it. I can't imagine.
And you know, you're on your feet for the entire day working in sort of these funny shifts. So when you're doing service, you literally don't have time to think. It's extraordinarily hardcore. And then in between service, you clear up, prep for the next service, or clear up and just pack up for the night. So it's just very full on. And I just was like, I'm not cut up for that. I talk too much, which you're not really meant to do in a professional kitchen. You've got to kind of get on with things.
And did you work a bit with Gordon himself? Was he working at that restaurant at the time?
He actually wasn't. And basically what had happened is, and it's all written about, it was all in the papers actually, because I've met him a few times there. And then I've met him several times since, but his head chef unfortunately died when I was working there. So he was completely elsewhere. And one of his friends had had an accident, basically, so I didn't see him. But I met him several years later at the opening of his first restaurant in New York. And I can't remember how I'd even got a table, but I managed to get a table. And I was with my sister. And he came straight up to me and was like, oh my God, how are you doing? Like, you were the mushroom picker. Because that's what I was sort of set to do when I met him. When I say mushroom picking, it was more like getting a teeny, teeny, tiny paintbrush and just flicking bits of dirt off mushrooms, but for hours and hours.
How lovely, though, that he remembered and that he came over and said hello.
Yeah,
brilliant guy. So then what happened after you did that work experience and your A-levels? What did you do then work-wise?
So I went to university, did a kind of rubbish degree, had the best time ever, came out, couldn't really get a job because I did a rubbish degree and had the best time ever, and decided that I was like, what do I like? What do I want to do? And I just didn't know. And then the only thing that I had ever shown interest in was food and cookery. And I knew that I didn't want to be a chef. So I thought, well, why don't you set up a range of products promoting the kind of food that you love? So I launched a brand called the Mighty Spice Company into Sainsbury's, actually. That is a very quick version of what happened. There was a Thai, a Chinese and an Indian sauce, fresh chilled, really lovely. And it was incredibly hard work, like getting it done, getting it made, getting it distributed. I mean, I had no idea. Like, I literally had never done anything like this. And I actually remember it was so long ago as well that it was before Google. So it was you Yahoo'd stuff. So I Yahoo'd how to launch a food brand. And about three things came up because it was just like too random and in the early days of the internet. It was great. It was very hard work. And then when the recession hit, by the time it kind of rolled into 2009, my sales had just nosedived. So it was the natural thing just to sort of walk away before it got, well, bankrupt is the word I'm trying to say. When I say it, I mean me.
Oh, and that's still hard to say even all those years later. But that is when you fled to Southeast Asia for some sun, sand and beer. And that trip really changed your life, didn't it, in many ways, John? What happened?
Yeah, it was amazing. So my brother was living in Hong Kong and I just thought, right, I need to get as far away from here as possible and let's go to Hong Kong. And it was brilliant. And we ended up doing a little trip together going into China and through Vietnam. And then I carried on. And at the time I was like, well, this is really lovely and all good, but why am I here and what am I doing? Am I just running away from my problems or can I get something out of this? And I was kind of happy with both, actually. It was quite nice to run away from my problems, but I decided to write a book whilst I was away, or at least get notes for a fake book is actually what I was more intending. It was just a good excuse, really. And what I'd seen while I was away was actually when you're in these amazing countries where spices are so ingrained into how they cook. Straight away, when people think of spices, they think of the sort of dry spices or sort of the whole seeds. But, you know, you've got loads of fresh spices as well. And certainly that's what they use in Southeast Asia a lot. It was sort of seeing that I thought, well, why can't I write a book that slightly demystifies these things? Because when you watch people cook with them who've basically used them their entire life, they make it look effortless and easy and explain why they're doing something. And it just sounded like quite a good gig, really, just to keep traveling and find out about it. And it happened, and I had an agent at the time, and she got me a book deal, and one thing led to another, and there you go.
And am I right in thinking, John, that you're dyslexic? So maybe a career as an author wasn't something you'd particularly considered.
No way. I did classical studies at university, which is not the classics, which is Greek and Latin. Basically, it's classical history. I had to hand in essays in certainly the first 2 years that were handwritten, and my handwriting is awful and my spelling is dreadful. I don't know anything about punctuation. I've taught myself about it now because I have to still, when I write, I have to speak it before I can write it because that will help me form a sentence. You can then kind of figure out where like a comma goes. But B's and D's, still a mystery. Don't know the difference at all.
That's and the what most editors annoying are thing for is, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but the most annoying thing is being dyslexic is the word dyslexic is the hardest word ever to spell ever. And I don't think I've ever been able to spell it without just putting into Google, just blah, 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 can't spell. And it pops up and then copy and paste.
What I love though, you kindly sent me a cookery book, which is my first one of yours.
Yeah.
And they feel like a real story and a travel book. You've got fabulous photographs. I love the fact that it's not just photographs of the dishes. When you're in all these exotic places, you take pictures or your photographer takes pictures of the local and the colours and all that kind of thing. And you do go often off the beaten track. So take us, first of all, if you would, to Morocco, the land of the rising sun, as you call it, and your first trip arriving in the dead of night back in 2007.
Yeah, let's go. My first trip to Morocco. Now, let me get this straight with you first. If this is when I was in Fez with my dad. Is that this story?
I know you've got a little torch and you...
Yeah,
you,
okay,
I read
right.
It in the cookbook.
I've had a few trips to Morocco where I've got there in the middle of the night.
It doesn't have to be the first one.
Is that a good one? This is the very first time I ever went to Morocco. Me and my dad. My dad's amazing and he's... loves to travel, and he'd read an article about this city called Fez that had the oldest working medina, or the second oldest, because actually it was Damascus at the time, and it was this incredible sort of like medieval walled town that's like a maze of these little streets and winding alleys, and then they spill out onto these big souks. So we were like, let's go. And everyone we knew had been to Marrakesh, and we thought, let's do this Fez thing, it sounds incredible. So we got there, and we literally arrived in the middle of the night in a car park, dropped off, and we did that sort of slightly nervous tourist thing where you've been given clear instructions, like the car's going to drop you off, someone's going to come and meet you, but you're like, oh, this is very dark, and it's a square next to a huge wall with no lights, and this was again pre having torches on mobile phones, and we just sort of stood there a bit nervously, and then this guy just suddenly, you just tiny little torch like appeared what looked like through the wall. And if you've ever been to Fez, it is magnificent. And some of the alleyways are so thin, you have to turn sideways. And there he was. And he was like the porter from our hotel. And we were there, like it was the middle of the night. It was late. He was like, come. Spoke no English. I still don't speak any Arabic at all. And we sort of followed this guy. And he just had this tiny, like a key ring torch. Do you know what I mean? Like just so little, so weak. It virtually didn't go anywhere. And also because the Medina is all painted, like, depending on the time of day, but essentially the same colour. So it was sort of very hard to see where we were. Then you just arrive at a door. And what's so wonderful about these Medinas in Morocco is everything's behind closed doors and the walls are very high. So we were just, like, you know, never seen anything like it, not that we could really see. Opened this door and you just walked into this, like, magnificent courtyard that was all open with a whole, like, an atrium open roof with this big cross of beams on the top and a massive sort of Arabic style chandelier hanging down. Just totally gobsmacked. And what was lovely is, and I actually love this about arriving somewhere in the night, when you wake up in the morning, it's different. You know, the air's different, the sun's up, you just sort of can see where you are for the first time properly. And it was just wicked. And I was totally hooked on that country from that trip.
I think it really is a magical place. I've only been twice. And although the Sahara Desert occupies great swathes of the country to the south, Morocco's incredibly fertile. Yeah. So not only have you got all those amazing spices, but you've got some brilliant food and fruit and veg, haven't you? I mean, really gorgeous stuff.
Absolutely. And I think what we are maybe traditionally fed about Morocco is the tagine. You know, that's pretty standard that everyone will know. And yes, they cook the tagines out there. And actually, tagines really are either used in kind of small villages and stuff. People will just use them to make an everyday stew that could be like a vegetable stew or a chicken stew. And they just happen to cook them in these pots because there's a lot of thought behind the conical lid keeping things very moist. So it just means if you're cooking over fire, you just slap it on, put your ingredients in, put the lid on and just leave it. Like we have a La Crusée, essentially. But the food is so much more than that. As you said, you've got the desert in the south, and in the desert, wow, you've got the date palms. So you drive through the desert and it's this red, scorched rock, nothing there, quiet, eerily quiet. And then you'll suddenly hear, after driving for hours, like squawking of birds that's so loud. And you kind of will go over a hill and down into a valley, and what you'll see is a huge date palm oasis. So there's a natural river called the Drar Valley. And this river goes through the desert, and all along it are these amazing oases, I don't know. you know, it's incredible. So you get the date palms and they're all irrigated. So they've got wild herbs and everything. But then further north where you get the mountains, so they've got different mountain ranges. You've got the High Atlas, the Atlas, the Rif mountains. They're very fertile. And as you say, like Morocco grows almost everything. So from like nuts and seeds and vegetables. And then what people always forget is it's the coast, it's the Mediterranean. So all along the coast, you've got these beautiful, slightly dilapidated looking like Greek towns where they're like, you know, whitewashed with blue roofs, but all a bit knackered. And you get amazing seafood. So you'll go to these towns and they'll just be grilling up fish everywhere. And that's sort of very un-Moroccan in terms of what we think of it.
I've spent time in the Atlas Mountains with the Berbers, and their hospitality and their warmth is legendary. I mean, you've been off the beaten track in places like Morocco and had some real adventures, haven't you, where families have sort of taken you into the sort of bosom of their home or bosom of their village, if you like. What are your favourite adventures that you've had there?
So I live in central London. You know, I'm in my little flat now. This is my world. I love the feeling of being plonked in the middle of nowhere. I find it totally thrilling, where I just feel completely out of my depth, where you've got to rely on people. And in Morocco, I had so many wonderful experiences. In the Rif Mountains, actually, I stayed with this village, and I just can't remember the name of it. It was a long time ago, and it had a long name. We got there quite early morning. So I was hiking. So I'd been hiking for a few days and staying in incredible places. And we stopped in this village, and it was sort of nestled onto the side of a mountain, and the mountain hid it from the morning sun. So it was absolutely freezing. And we'd been up since quite early to try and get there. And when we got there, they were so sweet, the family we were staying with. You know, they literally were huddled around cups of tea and a fire. But we started chatting. And so it was me and my guide, who was my translator, not a royal we. And and he was so cool, because he was saying, like, this village, they're really, really excited. I was like, stop it. And they were like, he was like, no, not about you. They've just got electricity put in last month. And I was like, oh my God, that's so bonkers. Like, electricity last month. And there was this sort of one ropey old cable coming down. So I was saying to the woman, like, you must be so pleased because you can get a fridge and you can, you know, make cooking so easy. And I know that that might sound a bit patronizing, but when you're talking about that part of the world where life is very simple, you know, the men farm, the women cook, that's sort of where it came from. And the guide told her, and she just laughed, and they started talking. And she was like, the answer came back, no, we're really excited about getting mobile phones because they haven't been able to charge them. So, you know, it was incredible. And it's just, and then another village that I stayed in the High Atlas, and I had my ginormous wheelie suitcase with me.
What do you like?
Massive, because I was away for like 3 weeks, but I just didn't really think about it. So I got dropped off at the end of a road that just disappeared. There was no road anymore, in the middle of nowhere in the mountains. And just standing there waiting, and I kind of are used to this now. So eventually the guide came to get me, but he was looking at me like, how are you going to get that into the village, mate? Like, it's miles away, up the mountain, down the other side. So I had that, I had a camera bag, and I just hadn't thought about it. I just thought this lovely car is going to take me there. So they had to get a donkey. This poor donkey had to carry all my stuff down into the village, much to everyone's amusement. But again, the village was amazing. It had no streets. It was tiny, little cluster of houses. At night, put the animals into the bottom of the houses and slept above them. It was extraordinary. That was the Berbers. Berbers are amazing.
When you're somewhere like that, do you find that the locals are sort of very happy when they realise your passion for food to cook for you and chat about ingredients? And then do you make little notes and things? What's the sort of process for your books?
When I'm planning a whole book, I'll think about a country. What are the big dishes that I want to know about? What are the big regions that I want to go to? And what are the big ingredients I want to know about? And I'll try and plan a route around that. And obviously everything's completely fluid anyway, because it will change when you get there. But the best thing for me is, like, what would a Berber woman cook her family on a Wednesday night in the mountains in the week? And it's not the kind of food that we would normally get access to. So that's what I want to know. And it is kind of, you've got to warm people up a little bit, because generally what I've found doing these things is everything gets lost in translation. So when I've booked my guide and off we go, in my head, you know, you kind of think we're going to arrive at this village and they'll know exactly why I'm there. No, they have absolutely no idea why I'm there. They've just kind of, by the time it gets down to the people you're staying with, it's usually just there's someone coming. So they're quite often like, who are you? Why are you here? And why are you getting so overexcited about everything we're eating? And then you sort of have to warm people up and tell them what you're doing and why you're doing it. If I can, I'll show people little clips about my books, because the books are very much a love letter to the countries. And I will talk about the people I meet and the places I've been to. And I wouldn't claim any of it as my own, because it isn't. It's funny, the reaction generally is just people are really cool. And I've been in Arabic countries where it can be, on paper, very difficult for a single man, unmarried man, to be near women. It's not really allowed, but it's sort of, you get round it. And I think people do see that I'm, you know, quite small and unoffensive and get very overexcited about food. And generally, they just quite enjoy it as well.
What are your other favourite places?
I mean, I love India. I find India just so incredibly full on. So I'm quite a kind of hyperactive person. So I respond very well to like a lot happening around me. And when you're in India, I don't know whether you've ever been, but it's just so full on all the time, especially in the north, in the big cities. It's like a sort of assault on your senses. You know, like good, bad, you know, good smells, bad smells, sight, poor, everything all at once, noise, traffic, elephants. I literally love it. I kind of thrive on it. I find it just, oh, wow, it's so cool. And then the food's just brilliant. But I've not been actually for quite a while. I did a lot of traveling last year, which was brilliant. I went to a small place called the Faroe Islands that are just sort of north of Scotland, which are just extraordinary. Like the little, if I say it right, archipelago of islands. Literally little rocks sticking out of the North Sea. And it's like Viking land. It's like little villages with grass roofs and people eat fermented, but essentially it's rotten lamb. But it was just incredible. It's like going back in time. But I think my sort of favorite thing that I've done, and it took a long time to set up, was I managed to go to Gaza last year. I've had a long fascination with Palestinian food. And I've been really lucky that I've been able to travel all around. I've been to Israel and I've been to the West Bank, and however you want to define those regions, you know, is one thing. But I'm going there to learn about food and people. And I've been very lucky to have gone to both and had incredible experiences and loved the food. After I came back from West Bank, I was like, well, look, I want to know more about Palestine and Palestinian regions, and Gaza was sort of quite an exciting place. So I work with a charity called World Food Programme, who are just phenomenal. They literally support millions of refugees all over the world, essentially give them like a credit card with prepaid money. Incredible people. Right now they're doing wonderful things in Beirut. You know, they were like that. And I went out there with them to do some filming last year to promote the charity, really. And God, it was incredible. Because to get to go to a part of the world that no one knows anything about, no one's ever going to go to, it was so fascinating. And the food there was just incredible. And what I love about food and travel is you never really know what's going to happen, which I do love. But food is a very instant connection. And for me to be in like a city, in Gaza City, which is just fascinating, I was able to connect on a very base level with the people I met immediately over the food. That just opened it up straight away. And it was just amazing.
I think it breaks down barriers, it breaks down the language barrier. I know that from spending time with the Berber community. I don't speak any Arabic either. And food is that shared passion.
Yeah.
But can you give us an idea? I haven't been to Gaza or Gaza City. Can you describe for us what it's like? Because I suspect most people listening to our podcast also have never been and wouldn't know what to expect.
Essentially, Gaza is a walled area on the side of Israel. And within Gaza, there's a few cities. So there's Gaza City, there's another city called Khan Yunis, and there's another city, which I forget what it is. So you're bordered by Israel and Egypt. Again, I was like, oh, I just thought it was one city. I didn't realize that there were two cities and what they would call little villages. And there's a little bit of farmland. And there's the sea. Getting through was extraordinary in itself anyway, because it's like getting into a prison. And it was all very full on. And I just rocked off a plane again with a huge wheelie suitcase, looking like I was an out of work drummer, wearing like skinny jeans, leather jacket, black shirt, black t-shirt, black sunglasses, so tired. And the guy who met me was like, what is this? They are not going to let you through security. Just, what is this? Did no one tell you where we were going? And I was like, yeah, but I just didn't really think about it. It's just like a passport control, isn't it? He went, no, it really, really isn't. So you go through and it's sort of, it's very full on, and you have to go through various different security checks and gates and all sorts of different zones. And it's all very, quite scary. And then when you go and you finally drive and you get to Gaza City, it's very dilapidated and run down because there's no money there. But I think in my head, like kind of everything to be just doom and gloom, and that's all I'd really ever heard about. But actually, and I'm not trying to say it's easy living there because it really isn't, but there was a lot of good there. There was a lot of amazing people who I met trying really hard to have a sort of normal life and bring their kids up. And then there was just really unexpected things, like the main market was just incredible. Beautiful old covered market with these funny like old goldsmiths to one side, all the food in the middle, these amazing like weird shops selling everything that you could ever want, all sort of subdivided, little hummus shops and cafes. In my head, I hadn't really been expecting things like that. And then The other big thing was there was a beach and you could just go and hang out on the beach. I mean, I wasn't allowed to. As a Westerner there, you're on a permit, so you're not actually allowed to go anywhere without security. And then you have to be in your hotel by 7. So it's very controlled about where you are and what you do for safety. But it was just phenomenal. And it was funny, my parents were really worried about me going. So when I got into my hotel, I decided to FaceTime them on my phone and just show them, because it was just a normal hotel. Like, you opened the cupboard and there was a little robe and some little slippers. There was a little mini bar with a pack of Pringles. And then you went to the window and you could see the sea. So I was like, you know, it's normal. It's just like a normal place. Absolutely extraordinary.
I think what's really lovely is that doing this work for the World Food Programme, you know, we tend to take our food a little bit for granted, I think, yeah. Don't we? We're so lucky that we can go to the market or shops or whatever and get what we want and put something nice on the table in the evening for our families. But it horrifies me how many millions of people around the world aren't lucky enough to experience what really is very normal and basic to us. And I love the fact that you're a chef and you're a writer and you care about that.
Yeah. No, I love it. It's funny, actually, because I found, as someone who goes to the Middle East a lot, you know, the second you start talking about the Middle East, you start talking about those refugees. And I felt that it was really important, as someone talking about that area, that I knew about it. So I actually contacted the charity when I was writing my Lebanese book to go. And I felt like I just wanted to go to some of the camps. So if you go to the east, there's this valley called Bekaa Valley, and it's incredible. So you drive over a mountain range and there's this misty valley, and there's another mountain range flanking it, which is Syria. It's where they grow the wine. It's the old wine region. I was like, what? I just didn't really think about Lebanon having loads of wine. And it is. It's just all vineyards. It's extraordinary. And that's also where all the refugees go, because they can get work. So obviously it's really hard if you're in a city, but if you're living in the countryside, you can get work as a picker. So the charity took me to one of the kind of slightly smaller refugee camps there. You're meeting these guys who've got literally nothing. And they're living in a small tent that they actually have to pay for, which I couldn't believe. And they have to pay for their electricity and pay for their own water. And yet they have a smile on their face and they've been through things that we could never imagine. A lot of them were living on literally like maybe like $18 to $20 a month. Such drive and such determination to go home and to get on with their lives. And I just felt it was really important to kind of know about this and be able to sort of talk about it. And then when you go to somewhere like that and you meet these kind of people, you just think, well, I've got to try and do more. What can I do to help? Whether that's going on a trip and writing about it for the charity, or going to Gaza and filming so they've got this footage to use to promote it, or doing events back here. And you get quite hooked on it. You know, you kind of think, what more, what more, what more?
And they're not little things, John. I mean, you've got a big reach now, you know, certainly in terms of your social media, as well as your presence on television. You can do stuff. And when you do go to places like that, you are getting the message across and allowing people at home to see what goes on. And it's a butterfly effect, isn't it?
Hopefully,
it takes somebody like you to go and do that kind of thing. And then people all want to chip in and help. Also, I'm sure, you know, when you're in India, you've seen a lot of poverty. You asked if I've been. I've never been to India. And I'm rather ashamed to say that I thought, before I started cooking with you on Instagram in my kitchen, I thought that I probably wasn't that fond of Indian food. And I know that sounds quite ridiculous, until I made your red coconut dal. And now I've been having that for breakfast, which my friend Yasmin, whose parents come from India, said that's what they do in places like Mumbai. You'd have the red coconut dal for breakfast. And so I would like to go, and you've opened my world up on that front. I mean, there, the flavours, the taste, the spices. And in southern India, what are your favourite dishes and your favourite foods?
The curries in South India, I'm actually just smirking thinking about them. Their ingredients are so different. You know, it's all coconut based. The north, they don't touch coconut at all. They just don't use it. Whereas in the south, they just grow everywhere. So you'll get like amazing salads with coconut in, or they have this beautiful like vegetable dish called a taran. And essentially, it's like a sort of stir fried veggies with loads of mustard seeds, curry leaves. They literally smell like a whole curry when you crack into them. It's extraordinary. And then grated coconut, or just the big seafood curries like crab or prawn or fish curry. They'll do a very rich coconut broth, spicy, fresh, lots of lime, and it's just delicious.
So where are you buying those from? Little restaurants and cafes then, if they're not on the street?
So the street food will tend to be like a snack, or quite often it's like a breakfasty kind of situation. So if you want a more sort of sit down meal, you would go to a restaurant. You wouldn't necessarily have like a whole fish curry on off the street. That's not to say there won't be people cooking it and there won't be people eating it off the street, because you get everything in India. But yeah, you just go to little restaurants. I mean, for me, the best thing is always try and get locals to cook it for you. And I know that can be quite hard on a holiday. So, you know, if you can, that's the best. But yeah, just lovely little restaurants. And, you know, if you see that there's local people eating in that restaurant, that's always a good sign. If it's good enough for the locals, it's certainly good enough for you.
And what are your favourite dishes and the favourite things you cook for yourself? I know you're a big fan of lamb.
I love lamb. I'm a bit obsessed with it, actually. So I live in Northwest London and there's just the most amazing Arabic shops here. So I kind of eat an awful lot of lamb. I do eat a lot of Middle Eastern food. I eat hummus every day. I eat a lot of like grilled meat, grilled fish kebabs. But I love Chinese food as well. Like really spicy Sichuan food. I absolutely love it with, you know, this sort of tongue tingling Sichuan peppers. And I just will throw them into a stir fry. And then I also absolutely love chocolate bars. You know, they're not that exotic, but oh my God, they're good. I always had quite a weird palate with chocolate. Like I was a bit snobby about it. I like nice chocolate bars. And then that's all totally changed this year. I've just rediscovered dairy milk with it. It's so delicious.
I think you'd go a long way to improve on dairy milk. I like all fancy brands too, but there's nothing really
something
like
comforting about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely delicious. Now, if people don't follow you on Instagram, obviously you're on telly sometimes. Sunday brunch is a favourite. What's cooking on TV like for you?
I love it because I love showing off and I'm quite silly and giggly. So the whole point of like really cooking on TV or on camera is to make it fun and make it exciting and make it look easy. So I absolutely love it. And I'm very lucky because I've been quite a regular on Sunday brunch and This Morning for a while. And I love it. And what they want me to do is not necessarily go and do like a really hardcore Middle Eastern or Indian curry, but like maybe pick an element out of one of them, chuck it into something more every day. And talk about it that way. And that's great. It's such a great platform.
I used to cook with different chefs when I used to fill in for Lorraine on ITV.
Oh.
And there was always a comedy factor because something always went wrong. And I like to get involved because otherwise you're there for 6 minutes in the kitchen and you feel like a bit of a spare part. So yep. I always ask, you know, people like lovely Dean Edwards.
Oh, I love Dino.
I love Dean. We used to go boxing together after the Lorraine show. But I'd always ask him for a job.
Actually, can I show you this? This is what's propping up my computer.
It's his new book. Cook Slow. I saw that on his Instagram the other day. Dean's absolutely fantastic. So he'd always give me a job, but he was always nervous about what to give me because if it involved a knife, then I'd cut my finger live on air. And then one day I remember putting some stuff in the whizzer and putting the lid on. I hadn't quite put the lid on properly and and it's all live, obviously, as you know.
Brilliant.
That was all quite good fun. And then I used to ask him where he went after the program because he'd always dash off after the program and he used to go boxing, so we used to do boxing together, years of health nut, and brought out beautiful books too. But also you've got a column in the Telegraph magazine, so how's that going?
It's great. And again, it was really interesting because really until last year I was doing mainly quite traditional Middle Eastern food, and then sort of last year I decided on social media that it was maybe fun to sort of mix it up and sort of temper things, and that's really what sort of started a lot of the work that I've done maybe in the last year and a half. It's almost using all that bank of knowledge and travel and experience and just putting it into sort of more everyday life. And the column in the Telegraph is for the Saturday magazine, forgive me, and it's called Saturday Supper Club. Each week will be a different dinner. I do it monthly. I share it with some other great writers. And it might be anything from like a mezze dinner where I'll do something Middle Eastern to I've just done, I think the next one coming out is pub grub. And I've obviously put a few of my little spins into something that's quite delicious and comforting for a cold day.
Well, John, thanks so much for joining me today. I mean, a massive thank you for inspiring me in the kitchen. And I really am looking forward to expanding my repertoire. So you must keep these Instagram cooking films going, please.
Of course. I literally love them. I love doing it. It's so nice. Every Wednesday, I go home, shoot with my mum, and I love it.
That was John Gregory Smith, food and travel journalist. He's well worth a follow on Instagram if you don't already. He's at JohnGS. And you can read his column in the Telegraph magazine on a Saturday and see him on our TV screens. I hope you're enjoying our Convex guests. There are plenty of chats to listen to at convex.podbean.com or search for The Convex Conversation on Spotify and Apple and Google Podcasts. I'll be back next week with another cracking guest, so bye for now.